August is Family History Month in Australia and New Zealand, so libraries and community groups across the country are holding events for anyone interested in giving the family tree a bit of a shake. It wasn't always this way, though. In the 1950s and 60s, the State Library of New South Wales Reference Library would refuse to make genealogical searches for readers. That's according to the library's Family History Service, which has now been running for almost 40 years. In Family History Month 2026, the library's session on Finding Family Stories was presented by someone very well known to ABC audiences, journalist Jane Hutchin, who was a longtime foreign correspondent and the host and creator of the One Plus One interview show. Since leaving the ABC, Jane's turned her own fascinating family history into a stage show, Lost in Shanghai. She also teaches storytelling and oral history to family historians with the Society of Australian Genealogists and writes about it regularly on her Substack, Jane Hutchin's Show and Tell. Jane Hutchin, welcome back to the ABC and to Sunday Extra.
Hi, Jules. It's good to be with you.
Great to be speaking with you. Jane, how did you become interested in the area of family history?
Well, I've kind of had it shoved at me for many decades, and I've constantly rebuffed the shovings. Even when the most interesting piece of information ever was given to me, which was the time I was the London correspondent in the mid-2000s, so we're talking 2005, 2006, and one of my uncles said something to me, and spoiler alert, I'm going to talk about a difficult subject here being taking your life, which is what exactly my grandfather did in Shanghai. But it shocked me when I was told that because my mum had never told me that. She'd always said that her father died when she was 13. She didn't mention how he died. And similarly, she had told me, you know, all the time we were growing up that her grandmother had divorced her grandfather, her grandmother being a Chinese woman and the grandfather being a Scottish man who had come to live in Shanghai. And I took her word for it. I didn't actually investigate the archives at the time to understand that a lot of Western men didn't really marry Chinese women. This is in the 1800s, say around the 1870s, 1880s, that they just, you know, sometimes these women were kept, sometimes they were prostitutes, and sometimes it was a very kind of short, shallow. In this case, this seemed to be quite a long relationship because my grandparents had three children and apparently two other children who hadn't survived over a sort of 10 to 15 year time frame. But I didn't question my mum about that when she said, oh, they split or they divorced. I didn't sort of think, oh, well, these unions were pretty rare at the time. So it wasn't until later, much later, that I then started investigating this, just as my mum actually was dying. I knew she didn't have long to go and I wanted to get the truth. But then it seemed, you know, as I was putting together Lost in Shanghai, the story of her life, and my mum was so frail and she had dementia. It wasn't, she could remember the past. She knew who we were all were, but she couldn't remember if she just had lunch or not. And this was not a good time to be interviewing someone about their lives, you know. And this is what I say to people, don't leave it too late to ask people the kinds of questions you want to know about your family story. So then I started going back. It was COVID. I went back into the archives and I got reminded by this piece of information I'd been told in 2006 because it was front page news on the Shanghai newspapers. My grandfather, the news of his suicide was front page news, and that just hit me between the eyes. So it was kind of like people calling me from the other end of the room and I kept ignoring them, you know, until it was too late. I was hooked already.
That really draws out an interesting aspect, I think, of family history. Is there a tension sometimes between wanting to honour predecessors and let them tell their story, but also scrutinising those stories and perhaps discovering uncomfortable truths?
Very much so. My mum said to me when I wrote my first book, which was about being a China correspondent, and I also put family details in, many of which have now turned out to be incorrect, as I've mentioned, But I remember my mum saying to me that, oh, you bring our family honor. And I don't really get that. I know a lot of societies use that sort of terminology, but for me, I'd have to say it was about my identity more than anything else. Because, growing up in Hong Kong, I always wondered, was I white or was I, I knew my mum was part Chinese. What is it about my identity? But I think as I've sat with it all those years, I also think, I've written posts about being angry at my Scottish ancestors. Of course, they had a hand in colonialism, although as far as I can tell, I haven't, I don't think there was opium trading. I don't believe there was slave trading. So actually, it'd be kind of exciting if I found something like that, but I haven't so far. But I think what it does do is it gives you a kind of empathy for those people because it was like, why did he not want to keep his children? Why did he leave China and leave his children and his family? And then he tried to have a child with an English woman. And it's so pitiful in the newspapers of the time. It says to Mr. Greaves, a son that's in the birth column. And I'm not kidding, in the death column right below. Mr. Greaves' son died aged 14 days old, so that was the legitimate child that he had who lived 14 days, but he had these other illegitimate children, so to speak.
Who weren't part of the record.
Exactly. And that hurts. I have to say, not being able to find birth certificates for my grandfather, any existence except for a headstone for my great grandmother, that really hurts and kind of makes you passionate. Okay, well, I'm going to renovate her headstone. I'm going to write about her so that she's not a nobody. It does all sorts of things to you, family history, but I think these are ultimately very human things. And I feel it's good to really understand and to try and constantly search for this kind of meaning. I think it's very important.
On Sunday Extra, we're talking about family history with former ABC journalist and now family history buff, Jane Hutchin. Jane also writes about family history on her Substack, Jane Hutchin's Show and Tell. Now, the State Library blurb for your session on finding family stories says that drawing together the threads of family history involves both practical challenges but also complex ethics. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I think there is a sort of ethical thing about, from a library's perspective, when you hold all this material that people have given you, and obviously some of it's very, very personal, and some of it's restricted. So not everyone can have full access to everything, or at least to publish that. So a library has to be very careful with how they go about dealing with all this material that people give them. And I think the ethical thing for me is, so I like to dive into Trove, for example, and I like to dive into things that I find in the State Library. I have to go and touch them. I'm a real geek. So I use all the technology to connect with the library. Sometimes I chat, just use the chat function to talk to the librarians. I go and book my box of old stuff, and then I go into the library and I have to touch it and I have to smell it. Does that sound really, really weird? I've got to get that whiff as it comes out of the box. And then that kind of hooks me into it. So the ethical thing is like, okay, has somebody given something personal? Is this something that the public deserves to know about? And a lot of people are very canny. They only perhaps give the materials or the papers or the writing that relates to maybe their one famous book or their 20 famous books. A lot of people don't always give diaries. Of course, the diaries are the fascinating thing, which really tells you how people thought at the time. And then there's also this whole growing area of oral history, which, as a former, well, I still regard myself as an interviewer and a journalist, I guess. That sort of stuff fascinates me because, as journalists, we have ethics in how we talk to people and how we use that material. And the libraries also have ethics in how people conduct oral histories. So there's the type in Indigenous history, for example, where information is handed down by oral storytelling. But then I guess in the Western sense, the last 70, 60 years, we've also done recordings of people, and then we've deposited those in libraries as well. And I think that's a really interesting issue because I don't think a lot of people who aren't really understanding of archives know where to find oral history. I think it's in a bit of an ivory tower. And I am very interested as a journalist in how people go about making those oral histories and also what they show of themselves. I think it's very interesting how oral historians, particularly ones who are no longer with us, have gone about making their oral histories. Historians are quite skeptical about this too, because how do we use that as historians? You know, do we say this was written, but then this person felt like this about it? So it's quite an interesting and sometimes thorny subject.
Well, anytime you're telling a story, you're making choices, and that always involves judgments that can be scrutinized. And Jane, you also teach family history and oral history through the Society of Australian Genealogists. What skills do you teach people who are interested in pursuing family history?
Well, I think as journalists, we are very used to taking a lot of information and putting it in an order which is connecting and relatable. So I teach people how to use their own family stories and to put it into a story structure, because a lot of people will struggle on a particular point and, you know, they might sort of go on and on and on about a birthplace and a date, and so-and-so was born in this city at this time, in this place, in this year. I try to get them to see, well, what else is the archive telling you about them? And what were the times in which they lived? And I used to do this on 1+1 when I was interviewing. If it was a really important moment, I might say, as we're sitting here talking at the moment, we've just had this terrible incident in the city or something like that. And I'd ask people, what does that make you think? What does that make you feel? Because we're not all just hanging on a hill's hoist or something like that. We're placed in time. You know, when we look back in 10, 20 years at this crazy kind of global situation that we're living in at the moment, that forms part of our family history as well, because we make decisions based on some of those global things happening around us. And so I always get people to sort of build in, well, what was it like for a girl going to school at that time? What was it like to live in the countryside? Did you wear shoes at that time? So I just try to add a little bit of history and humanity in there. And then I think stories are useless if they're kept in a drawer. We really need those to leap off the pages literally. So what I like to do is teach people how to make 5-minute slideshows, you know, that they could bring out at an 80th birthday or something like that. Slideshows that they tell of their own family. But I guess, you know, you might minimize some parts of that story and kind of make other parts more detailed so that they really flow and they take the audience with them. And I think that's much better than, you know, writing a 50-page report that never jumps out of the top drawer.
And we've heard how much you love getting your hands on the actual original archival material. And through the work that you've done, you also do find lost stories in archives and bring them to media attention. Can you give us some examples of how you've done that?
Yeah, well, I found a story about a cricketer, a female cricketer in the 1930s. And I got really obsessed with her. Her name was Hazel Pritchard. And I discovered that she had a sister, Edna Pritchard. And apparently the two of them were in a number of sports teams. And because, you know, when they finished school, probably at 14 in those days, there was quite a lot of free time apart from their work. So Hazel Pritchard actually was in the first women's cricket test against England, where the Brits came over to Australia, and then she went over to England in 1937 in the second test. And there wasn't one till after the war. I didn't find her archives first up. What I did was, after I did plenty of research about her, I thought, what do her descendants think? You know, like, I didn't even know we had a women's cricket team in the 1930s. And in fact, her nickname used to be the Girl Bradman. So I did what a journalist does, and I found one of her descendants and I contacted them. And before I knew it, I was in the car on the way to Orange, and this man who works with the Orange local government, his name is Ben, he said, oh, we've got a trunk in one of the rooms that I haven't really opened. And anyway, when I arrived in the house, he had the trunk open and just a table filled with ephemera, which is kind of, you know, old programs and that sort of thing, photographs. And they even had Hazel's cricket bat that she was given when they toured England. And in Nottingham, the cricket bat maker made them all a personal bat. And
wow,
he showed me that cricket bat. And it was extraordinary. And I also met her son. So Hazel's son is still very much alive and kicking. So they fleshed out stories for me and showed them what material they had. I just love this idea that they're in history, but there's always a link to the present. And so by finding their descendants, you kind of find out the sequel to the prequel, if you know what I mean. And yeah, it was just very, very wonderful. And so what I do now, I've written quite a few pieces about Hazel and Edna. I'll now go on a bit of a sort of speaking tour to libraries and things like that, telling those stories. The research is always there. It always grows, but it's always shared as well. So yeah, I just love doing that. And I'm working on something at the moment, but maybe I'll tell you more about it when it's published.
Watch this space. Sounds good. Jane, obviously there are great free and public resources that can be mined for family history. What are your thoughts on the pros and cons of commercial services like Ancestry.com compared to, you know, going fully DIY in the library?
Yeah, look, I think we have to have both. I think the library's resources are phenomenal. All of Australia has got amazing state libraries. So pretty much anyone who has an address and one form of ID can get access to their state libraries. With people on the other end of emails who actually do answer things, who can give you direction, because they're all trained, they're research librarians, which I think's incredible. But I also do use paid platforms as well. Personally speaking, I think you need both. What I tell people is use Ancestry, but you can always pause it after you've done your initial research. Say you've done it for 3 months, pause it for a while until you're ready to jump in with something else. And in fact, it's the Ancestry stuff that has helped me find descendants. But the other tip I have is not to ignore your local history societies, because these have got masses of documents from those particular areas. So if you're researching ancestors from a specific area, they're quite quiet often because they don't have the funds to publicize things, but usually they're open 1, 2, maybe even 3 days a week. They have very helpful volunteers, and you can go and find the lay of the land, even if it's only about what a particular suburb was like at a particular time. That's really useful stuff. So I think we're kind of awash with really good facilities in this country and helpful people, because I think anyone who's involved in family history and local history, they don't do it because anybody wants them to. They do it because they're just passionate about it.
Jane, I was surprised that last year on Substack you wrote that you'd come to the conclusion that you would not digitize everything significant in your family history collection. Why was that?
Okay. I'll tell you one reason why I think you should only digitize the key stuff, because you're creating almost like a burden for the next generation. And I think you shouldn't just kind of dump on them. I really think you should be careful in terms of, okay, what's important? You've got to leave some stuff for them to find out too. So I just, looking at my own amount of stuff, I know that it would be unfair to just heap that on someone else. So if I said that, it was probably relating to, you know, pick the gold and the gold dust, perhaps leave that, or even if you dare, chuck it. Because again, I don't want to burden my daughter. I don't want to add a burden to anybody, you know, and they might come to family history in a very different way. They might not even be interested. So you can't just hang on to trunk loads of stuff out of fear, I think. You've got to make the hard decisions yourself.
Well, Jane, it's been great talking family history with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Julian. Thank you.
That's Jane Hutchin, former ABC journalist, now teaches oral history and storytelling for the Society of Australian Genealogists. And you can find Jane's work at her Substack, janehutchin.substack.com.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.